NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello there.
Good to see you, John.
Hi, John.
And today we're joined with a good friend, a former person who's been on our show multiple times, Mr. Mike Borfus. And today his presence is particularly pointy because he recently wrote an editorial for AvWeekly talking about the ODA system in Boeing. And I feel that he's more than qualified since he spent about 15 years at Boeing and about 20 years with the FAA, part of that overseeing ODAs. And his comments were quite controversial in the guest editorial that he had.
Before and we go to that, could you explain to the audience what an ODA is and what an ODA does and why Boeing or anyone else should give a whatever about it?
All right. So, Mike, why don't you do that? Because I think you might be better versed than I.
Yeah, sure. ODA is organizational development. The acronym is Organization Designation Authorization, which is really silly. So we just use ODA in the colloquial. Organizational delegation goes back probably 50 plus years, and it's the FAA authorizing an organization with the proper qualifications and integrity to actually take over the approval of data. The FAA will then essentially audit their work and come in from time to time and verify their approvals. There are ODAs for maintenance, for production, and for type design approvals as well. STCs, supplemental modifications on aircraft, and so on.
And you've been involved in this business for about 40 years, directly or indirectly, correct?
Absolutely. Certification and safety, I've been involved directly in since 1980, 44 years.
And Mike, you actually run. Oops.
Oh, go ahead.
And Mike, go back to the ODA.
Yeah. Right?
There's a couple, three requirements from the FAA for you to be able to have one. And they're sort of generic.
Yeah, they are. I mean, first of all, you have to have the expertise. You have to have a facility. You have to know exactly what it is you're going to be working on. You have to essentially be qualified. Any designee has to demonstrate to the FAA that individual can perform and actually has the integrity to do the right things at the right times.
You okay, mentioned so integrity.
Yes.
Go ahead.
What happens if that's called into question?
Then you have to make it up. You have to do something to demonstrate again that your performance is where it needs to be. Performance and integrity are the two key words that Kilroy Aviation uses. When you perform, you do the very best job you can. You do it quickly, you do it effectively. And if you do something improperly, if you make a mistake, that goes back into integrity. You tell on yourself, you do what needs to be done to correct the error. You cycle it through your performance a couple times until you know that it's corrected, and then you move forward. Integrity is basically telling on yourself when it's required and then fixing it.
And you mentioned Kilroy Aviation. That's the ODA company that you're the CEO of, correct?
That is correct. Yep.
All right. So going back to a little bit of 101 here, ODA, I think common sense would tell you this was probably a budgetary issue initially. There just aren't enough FAA personnel to do the job of inspecting on a factory floor. Is that the basic reason why this whole program exists?
I would say yes. You know, the FAA total staffing has less than 1,300 people. And you take away probably about a quarter to a third of those people, and you'll wind up with engineers and inspectors of, you know, three figures, maybe 900 people, give or take, who are accountable for the safety and airworthiness of everything that's made, everything that's put in the air, every engine, every tire, every lavatory door handle, windshield, and so on, everything, including spares and original aircraft.
Okay, now, those 1,300 people, that's aircraft certification, because people are going to say, the FAA has more than 1,300 people.
Yes, thanks, John. Yep, that's absolutely correct. The other organization is Flight Standards. They're accountable for airline oversight, for mechanics, for training, for all the operational related stuff, you know, such as repair stations. They have about twice as many people. But you put these two organizations together, they hold hands. They're kind of a hand-in-glove relationship they have. And you just take a look outside of the people who are actually working in aviation, who are designing and building and maintaining and flying these aircraft, every flight attendant, every CEO, there are millions of people out there. When you talk about 5,000 or 6,000 people in the FAA, those two organizations, there's no way they can be expected to oversee and guarantee the safety of a product, period, end of story.
Okay, what's the solution?
The solution is first of all, to assure that the accountability and airworthiness of a product resides with the operators and the manufacturers. That allows the FAA to delegate a lot of their work, which again goes back to integrity. You know, just a little while ago, we talked about the Supreme Court in 1984 actually determining, making the finding that the airworthiness and accountability of a product resides with the manufacturer and the operator, not the FAA. The FAA can only be expected to spot check. That's all they can do because they're so badly outnumbered. And that puts the requirement for performance and integrity in the hands of companies like Boeing.
Is there a way to make this system work, or is it kind of fundamentally flawed when you're asking a company to police itself? I think on the surface, we see an inherent problem there. And no matter how much integrity a person has, you know, we know where our bread is buttered, ultimately, at least subconsciously. So is there a way to, because I think we can accept the fact that there's not going to be a force multiplier for the FAA. They're not going to have an order of magnitude more inspectors. That's not going to happen. Congress is not going to do that.
Right.
So is there a third way? Is there a way to have independent oversight in a way that is affordable for the taxpayer and has the kind of objectivity that we all need in this industry?
Well, you just led me right straight into my little opinion piece. Yes, an ODA can actually do that. ODAs are essentially a branch of the FAA. Now, our ODA, we were having our weekly discussion with our FAA Oversight Office not too long ago, and I had this feeling just kind of wash over me that it felt exactly like we were another branch inside that FAA office. It was really, really nice. And that's what you get if you work, if you have high integrity and your relationship with the FAA is based on, reality, I guess you might say. Now, an ODA then is able to leverage the FAA authority. And they're also able to provide services that that a client or a customer might need. We can turn over an STC, basically a modification of an aircraft, in a quarter of the time that it would take the FAA. That allows the FAA to work in other areas, like their primary purpose is safety. Basically, keep the skies safe. So they can delegate these things now. In some cases, I think that, I'll just kind of give you a brief review of what I wrote up in my opinion piece. Basically, we could have an ODA that takes over the FAA's role in approving Boeing products, and also probably production as well, two very different critters. But the type certification ODA would be physically separated from the FAA. They would also have embedded FAA individuals who are directly working with the ODA, which is unique. There are no ODAs I'm familiar with that have FAA people embedded. And that would allow the relationship to build and become a trustful relationship while the FAA is actually looking right into what the ODA is doing. Now, the Boeing company has an ODA right now. They have two ODAs. They have one for production, another one for type certification. The type certification ODA has probably about 1,000 individual members who are inside that FAA, maybe more. And from my own experience in the Boeing company, engineers are siloed. There are so many engineers there that one engineer can barely know what another engineer is doing if they're working in different disciplines. So, you know, a full systemic perspective is a difficult thing for these individuals to see. And it happens. It just happens. An anecdote that I mentioned earlier is simply that when I was working for another company, working directly with Boeing, I tried to find the person who was responsible for O-wings, the O-ring expert inside the Boeing company, and it took me a couple of days to find that person. Now, that says a lot about how specialized and compartmentalized these individuals are. And here's another thing I want to add. These individuals can only be marketable inside the Boeing company. If you want to work outside, you better know exactly what's going on. You better know everything about how an airplane goes together, how the system works, how the process works, and so on and so forth. And when you're in the Boeing company, you're so narrowly defined in your profession, you can become trapped. You can become a hostage, you might say, because you know you're not marketable outside the company. Therefore, if somebody comes to you and says, your job right now depends on you making this decision, that's what you're going to do. And sometimes they actually do it. You know, we know that people have been cornered. They've been subjected to abuse, undue influence, undue pressure, so on and so forth. That can happen. A third-party ODA, the odds are very, very much lower than that, at least in part because the FAA will be embedded with them.
Let me add something to that from my experience working on the 777 project. First, the fact that you might not know everybody there. That was the case with me. There were about 10,000 engineers in the 777 program. And as I told you folks earlier, there are a few times where I went to a meeting with a bunch of engineers and technicians, never saw them before. We all worked at Boeing, and I never saw them again. I was working on this project for several years. And also there were people within the organization, designated engineering representatives, DERs, who had a dual responsibility. They were working on behalf of the FAA, but at the same time, their paycheck came from Boeing. Now, how do you reconcile that? You have the money coming from one place, and you're answering to some person over here who might be not going in favor of the people who are handing you the checks. I can say this. It worked during the 777 group. I was there during 737 MAX, so I can't speak to that. But I was intrigued by that, and I was really impressed by the level of integrity and ethics that was demonstrated by these DERs and others who had those kinds of dual responsibilities.
Yeah, let me speak to that. At the working level, the Boeing company has some magnificent people, some absolutely wonderful people. I was an associate technical fellow for safety and certification inside Boeing customer support. In that position, I was able to actually participate in the safety boards that were held both by every single model of the Boeing company and the FAA as well. And what was interesting is I was able to talk to one and then the other in basically the same language. The fleet chiefs, who are the individuals who are accountable within customer support at Boeing, are the ones who have to deal with the in-flight, the operational difficulties, the problems, and so on. And they were really, really good. They'd have these boards almost weekly. They would talk about what's right, what's wrong. They'd talk about possible safety issues, and they did a really good job. And the FAA, of course, was interested in being there because that was my old turf at the time. And the FAA does what they need to do. The FAA depends completely on what's provided to them on potential safety issues. A type certificate holder was required to inform the FAA when they see something that could be potentially safety related. So at the working level, the fleet chiefs and their staffs actually did a great job. Their relationship directly with the FAA was very good. The FAA rarely, if ever, was actually caught off guard on a potential safety issue. And the fact is that, a lot of people, we're technical people. We depend on our reputations. We must work with the highest integrity. And when one of us is cornered, there's not much an individual can do except obey, push back, stop, or blow the whistle. Those are sort of the things that are available to them. Blowing the whistle is something that people just don't like to do. Because behind bars, snitches get stitches, right? And you know, there's potentially a price to pay, especially if you're not right. We have people in the technical world who are, they're chicken littles, you know, they always think something is wrong, the world's going to come apart. You have to be able to understand where they're coming from, but also be able to parse and decide exactly what's true about what they're saying. If somebody comes to you with a potential problem, you have to investigate it. If you don't investigate it, you've got guilty knowledge. And we don't want guilty knowledge. So you do the right things. So again, you know, I don't know how many whistleblowers there were inside the company, but we know there are one or two whistleblowers from the FAA. We know there are several whistleblowers inside the Boeing company. I think we lost two of them in the recent past. And it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing to be a whistleblower. I've known a few.
Not to the faint of heart.
Right.
So what's on the minds of many in the aviation community and the average traveler is the recent things with Boeing. The two crash with the 737 MAX, the plug door blowing out in January of 2024. And as we speak, this is July 11, 2024, we have Boeing's spaceship, the Starliner, in orbit at the space station, International Space Station, and we don't know when they'll be able to come down home again. Mm-hmm. Now, these are all from the same company, very large company. These events happen over many years. Which ones are the most important with respect to the issues that you are talking about right now?
Oh, gosh. First of all, what really bothers me is that those two accidents, Lion Air and Ethiopia, were almost 5 years back. No, they happened quite some time ago. The Boeing company agreed they're going to fix this. They're going to be, you know, they're going to take care of it. They're going to just, you know, get back to their integrity. And they failed. They just have not done it, which led to the recent DOJ decision to you know, work this deal with them. And they're now a felon company. I, you know, I have no idea exactly why it happened, but I certainly know what happened. It's an extension of the things that started happening some time ago. I was at Boeing from 1980 to 1985, and then from 1997 to 2004. The first time I was there was kind of a golden era, the 757, 767 programs. Everybody was proud of these aircraft. They were proud to work with a Boeing company. Boeing company was the only game in town. That was before Microsoft and before Kirkland and, you know, before Amazon. And it was just felt really, really good. I was so proud to work for the Boeing company at the time. You know, when I went back in 1997, decisions were made differently. The first thing that I was told was that you have to be aware of shareholder value. Everything you do, make sure that shareholder value is addressed and on the front of your mind, the first things you got to deal with. And you know, a company's got to be, has got to be profitable if they're publicly owned. But by the time I left the Boeing company after about 7 years, one of my favorite lines was that based on my experience there, the Boeing company was only making a commodity. That's all they were making. Might as well have been toasters. I used the toasters analogy a lot when I was leaving. I was more sad, I think, than bitter or angry because they were still cranking out some pretty good products. But it was very, very difficult for me to find any notion inside the company that the safety and airworthiness and integrity of their products was foremost in their minds. It just wasn't there. And people had moved up through the company who actually bought into that. We can go back to the notion of you know, people who can have some authority without accountability. And that's what I see is one of the things that happened. They had authority without necessarily understanding what they had authority over or what the impact of their decisions might be.
Now, going back to 1997, the critical year for Boeing, that was the era when there was the merger with McDonnell Douglas. Full yep. disclosure, I used to work for McDonnell Douglas in the early 80s. And I remember sitting in the offices when this was happening. I thought, oh, for fun, let me just look at the Securities and Exchange Commission documentation, which is the public documents that any publicly traded company had to put out there. And looking at this with a halfway decent analysis, it was pretty clear to me that financially speaking, McDonnell Douglas was coming from a very different place. They were at that time very good at enhancing shareholder value. And they did so at the cost of shortchanging long-term research, selling off pieces of the company, doing things to, the analogy I used was, they were burning the furniture to keep the house warm. House was mm-hmm. pretty warm. And a lot of that higher level management went over into Boeing after that, and they infused that sort of point of view into how things were done at the very highest echelons. And again, I'm not saying there's a direct relationship, but you know, there's a correlation there. And hey, you know, it didn't happen by accident.
Yeah, that's well said. You know, the favorite phrase inside the company was that that McDonnell Douglas bought Boeing with Boeing money. You know, and there were a lot of people who moved up to Seattle, and they just were placed in positions of high leverage, I guess you might say. The upward mobility of a lot of people who had grown up in the Seattle Boeing company was just not there for quite some time, there's a lot of truth to that. There's a guy, a vice president named Walt Gillette. I don't know if you recognize that name. Walt Gillette was known as the father of the 787. He had this little brain trust put together to take a look at, it was around 97, 98, to take a look at what might happen next in the Boeing company. They came up with a blended wing body. They eventually led to the 787. When I was working in quality in one of the flash cubes, the big cube glass buildings that are in Renton, I had been working late and I saw Walt just sitting there on a couch. The office was dark. He and I were the only people there. And I sat down and talked with him a little bit. I was really impressed. But what he said was that, and this is after the merger, what he said was that his real concern was that the Boeing company, Seattle, would wind up following the model of McDonnell Douglas and just start modifying older models to the point that they just became useless. He used the phrase, and these models would eventually wink out. And that's exactly what happened to McDonnell Douglas. You know, thank God the 787 actually came along. They did a pretty good job on that. But he was really concerned about, and if anybody would understand the danger of that kind of behavior, Walt Gillette was one of them. It was a really nice discussion I had with him, and I remember it to this day.
So I had a couple with him myself, and he was very impressive, very impressive.
He really cared. He had a heart.
So help me understand, Mike, so I'm clear. If you have kind of an independent ODA, not necessarily a Boeing employee or whatever, first of all, who's paying for that? Is that money that comes from the FAA, or how does that get funded?
Well, I can talk to you about our organization. Our ODA has three full-time employees. That's it. That's all we have. We have a roster, and each of us came from different parts of the country, Southwest, East Coast, and Northwest. Each of us brought our own Rolodexes in, and we combined all our contacts. Right now, we have between 70 and 80 unit members, basically DERs, in almost any discipline you could possibly mention. So what happens is we're kind of a brokerage firm, you might say. Somebody comes in with a project. We tell this outfit that, okay, this is what you want to do. Get the engineering done on your own. Go ahead and take care of it. We'll sign a contract with you folks for us to take care of the approvals. And you put together a program manager. We'll work directly with that program manager. When the work is supposed to be done, find yourself a repair station to do the work, and we'll take care of the rest. So basically, I guess maybe brokerage is probably not a bad phrase to use. And the people who work with us are on contract from time to time. A typical, right now, we're actually working on a project that turns an old Southwest Airlines 737 into effectively a big crop sprayer. We rip the interior out. We put in big tanks, 6,000 gallons more or more of tanks, and they fly over oil spills for oil spill recovery. And that's a big, big deal. You know, you rip all the interior out, you have to change the structure, you have to put plumbing in, you have to put these big booms in there outside the tail. And guess what? We inside Kilroy have done really none of the work with respect to the designing and the testing and so on, but we make damn sure that everything is done properly, because we understand how this thing works. We understand the process, and we understand who needs to do what. And then when we agree on what needs to be done, we put a plan together. We send it off to our FAA oversight organization. They take a look at it. We talk them through it. We reach agreement on what needs to be done. We put together what you might call a contract, and we just follow that contract step by step by step. We keep the FAA apprised weekly of what's going on with this project, and their part is done. So their resource allocation for something like this is probably going to be, a total of five, six, seven work hours a week max among 3, 4, 5 people. They do have a flight test organization. They're going to have 2 or 3 flight test people out there. That's just because this particular modification is very significant, and they would like to take a look at it and not only just see it for themselves, maybe fly the aircraft, but they want to see how we do it. So
help me understand, though, the manufacturer, or in this case, the company doing all these, this giant STC kind of to modify this aircraft. So they pay your company, but you answer to the FAA. Is that how it goes? And in other words, if that company, or if you were doing this for Boeing, for example, could they fire you or in some way intimidate your people in some way because they're actually writing the check? How does that work? How do you insulate your people, in other words?
That's where the three of us come in handy. That's our job. We protect our people. It's our job to protect our people. Our business is good enough right now that we can afford to lose an applicant, a customer. Now, of course, one thing that we have working to our advantage is simply the fact that if somebody decides to fire us, first of all, the FAA will take notice. They're going to call us up and say, what in the hell is going on with this thing? Second, they'd have to start over. They'd have to go find another organization. They'd have to do it themselves, which is very, very difficult. And it would just, let me say this. Within the FAA, for type certification, there might be 400 or 500 people. And it's a very tight network. If somebody does something improperly, everybody knows about it. And nobody has to be a whistleblower. No one has to talk about it. If we get fired by a company, we just tell our oversight office that, hey, guess what? We just got fired. We're done. They've moved on. And that's all we have to say. So
could this, is there a potential solution here to Boeing's woes? I mean, we're, you know, talking about the merger and the stockholder share, there's so many areas where Boeing has to kind of do a big rethink here, but this is a big one. Is it possible to imagine, you know, outsourcing this ODA job and in some ways having an appreciable impact on the quality on the factory floor?
I've got many different directions going in my head right now. Let me try to address that. It begins with what I just discussed. The people who are managing, who are at the top of the heap, top of the pile inside an ODA, have to be strong. They have to be knowledgeable. They have to be able to say no without equivocation. They have to be able to just draw the line, and nobody shall cross that line. So with that, could you rephrase that question for me, please?
Well, I'm curious if you come in, as opposed to having, you know, outright Boeing employees, is, you know, Todd, I find it interesting that Todd remembers a day when a person who's getting a Boeing salary could have some integrity in the process and feel confident enough to speak up. It sounds like that whole climate has changed dramatically. And so we can't bring in FAA inspectors and not enough of them, but there's a cadre of people like you who have a lot of knowledge and experience who could come in as sort of contractors to try to serve this purpose. That's what I'm after. Is that, is that a practical idea?
Yes, I believe it is. And here's why. I think, first of all, it minimizes the FAA oversight. The FAA has an organization that oversees the Boeing ODA and could use as many as 100 FAA engineers. That entire workload would shift to an ODA, probably 5, maybe 6 FAA people, maybe one manager and a handful of engineers and inspectors. And it could even save resources for the Boeing company. Now consider what it costs to have these 1,000 or so UMs, unit members, working inside the Boeing company. They have to manage them. They have to do what needs to be done. They don't want to fire them because Lord knows where they're going to need this individual for another O-ring exercise. So an ODA could actually hire, you know, bring in contractors as necessary for a particular project. The process oversight would require, I don't know, maybe 20, 30, 100 people. I don't know, not a whole lot of people, but the total full-time employment would not be great. Contractors would come and go, and they'd be paid by project, as opposed to the Boeing company continually having 1,000 UMs on board, plus their management administrative support. So because of that, it may actually work to Boeing's benefit in the long run, once they get used to the idea of not having this organization in the palm of their hand.
Well, but I think you hit the key point. it could save the company money, right? You've got a company that's about shareholder value here, maybe not as much about safety, but if you could hit them on that point, maybe that's a win-win, potentially. I mean, what would it take to make this happen?
We have to talk about the difference between saving money and being in control. And that's what it boils down to in my mind. You know, the just to expound on that a little bit, you know, the FAA and the Boeing company, high administrative folks, don't trust somebody who's outside the company because they can't have them under their thumb at any given moment. And when they have somebody outside the company, physically distanced from the company, with FAA people on board, where a UM, where actually any employee inside the Boeing company could go, walk in the back door, quietly be seen and heard by these individuals, and not get caught, not getting busted for being a whistleblower, it says a lot about the integrity of the entire potential system. And that's what the Boeing company, many individuals, I guess, the Boeing company would be afraid of. And something I learned a long time ago, somebody once told me that anger is the mask that fear wears. And I believe the Boeing company would be very fearful of this whole thing, of individuals just kind of slipping out from under them. And I just, the more I talk about this, the more I think about this, this possibility, the more I believe it can actually work.
Now, let me get back to your op-ed for a minute, where you talked about this, saying that, hey, having a third-party separate ODA for a couple of years or more at Boeing might allow them to turn the corner. Now, you're not in any way, shape, or form pitching your company because, like you said before, you don't need the business. In fact, you're doing so well you can afford to lose a client now, you'll keep on sailing. So this is not a sales pitch on your part. You don't want to be Kilroy Aviation doing this job for Boeing.
No way. no way. You know, I think, I wrote this piece. I came up with the idea. I would love to be able to be part of maybe developing the whole thing because that part would be fun. But for actually putting the company together and running it and having it actually work, first of all, it's going to be probably 3 to 5 years to get it up and running. Second, they're going to have to be some people who are well-regarded, have a high profile in the industry. You know, like maybe we could name a few folks who have been vice presidents, CEOs, et cetera, and have good, solid reputations. They're the ones who would have to stand between Boeing and the ODA. And frankly, I don't think I'm one of those people. And that's okay. That's perfectly fine with me. I'm 75 years old. I'm very happy with where I'm at. I'm in love with what I do. Probably shouldn't say this, but my wife would like me to take a little more time off. But, you know, the three of us are very happy. We have something. It's a going thing right now at Kilroy Aviation. And once again, back to how the whole thing would work. The Boeing company has this ODA they work for. They treat them exactly as they would treat the FAA. The ODA would be paid for by the Boeing company, who may actually over time save money. And the ODA under the FAA authorization and under their regular audits, not to mention the people embedded with the ODA, would also help give the FAA and the fine public a lot of confidence as well. The public probably isn't going to even see this or understand the nuances that we're talking about. But still, it's something that goes far, far beyond just having an oversight organization. And speaking of that, by the way, if they have a monitor, they're talking about a 3-year monitor for the Boeing company. Mm-hmm. That comes to an end after 3 years. The Boeing company can hold their breath for 3 years. The Boeing company has established the fact that they are not really good at managing the integrity of the company. That's an easy enough thing to say. We know that it's a difficult thing to do, but they have a track record. And if it goes back to the Boeing company, it would be business as usual, potentially. And the Boeing company could then just sort of drift away back to where they were before. They can make promises. They have made promises that they haven't fulfilled, that they haven't lived up to. In this case, it would be this organization smack in the middle of the Boeing, between the Boeing and the FAA, that would assure, because of the relationship with the FAA, that they would work properly. And not only that, let's talk Darwin here. If an ODA stood up working for the FAA and Boeing at the same time, the only thing they depend on is their own integrity. That's the thing that really, really matters. If they don't show the integrity, if they don't have the performance of making these approvals, then they lose everything. They get shut down by the FAA. You know, probably never be that bad, but corrective action is something they would never want to see. That is the one absolute Darwinian issue that they really have to deal with. So that works as well. Once again, there's another argument for this whole thing to just be real.
You know, it occurs to me, you at 75, you have so much seasoning and experience in this business. And what we've seen at Boeing all throughout the aviation industry is we've seen this terrible brain drain, right? We've lost a lot of people for a lot of reasons, COVID being, accelerating that whole thing. And you've got, my understanding is you've got a lot of people that are very inexperienced on that factory floor. They've really cut back the amount of time they have for training. They've reduced the number of safety people looking over their shoulder. And then you've got people who are on the payroll who are supposed to be checking off the boxes for the FAA. It's so many levels. And as you point out, it's so complex anyway to get people up to speed. This is not an easy thing to turn around. I mean, it's a long way of saying this is like turning around a battleship to get Boeing back on course here. And they're building aircraft, which are all going to fly in the meantime. Mm-hmm. What's the message to give the public in all of this? You know, as this company, and we don't have any great confidence it can turn itself around at this point, but let's assume it does. It's still going to take a long time.
Absolutely. This again goes back to the notion that a three-year monitor assignment is just not going to do it.
Right.
A monitor is an individual or a small group of people. And in my mind, it's a black and white sort of a thing. A monitor is a hammer. And we know what a hammer does. It looks at everything as if it's a nail. You know, right? So the Boeing company just hunkers down. They put up with it for 3 years, and then it's over. The switch is flipped, and they can go back to where they were before. So now another thing about having a monitor, by the way, is also the fact that the 3 years of having a monitor on board is 3 years that could be used to put together this ODA. So the switch is flipped off. The monitor goes away, the ODA comes on board, and we're good to go. Now, I want to differentiate, by the way, you know, there's a production certificate and a type certificate. The production certificate is, you know, the folks on the floor and so on. That's a process that's a process authorization certificate. And the type certificate is I call it a noun versus a verb. Process is a verb. The FAA gets the Boeing company gets their type certificate. Anybody gets a type certificate, that's a noun. They can put it up on the shelf. They don't have to do a dang thing with it after they're done. But the thing is that process oversight from an ODA then turns the whole thing into more of a production orientation thing because it's process ownership. Another thing I want to say that is in defense of the Boeing company, and that is that, Todd, you remember the 777. They had an iron bird there, right? They put all the software together. They exercised the whole thing. They ran into glitches. The Boeing company is one of their prize possessions, you might say, is the fact that their systems integration. Integrating these complex systems is getting more and more and more difficult. When it was all nuts and bolts and cables and lights and electric motors and so on, it was a lot easier for them to do the systems integration. Right now, it is a huge, huge deal. And frankly, I think they would have a lot of trouble doing that. And sure as hell, I seriously doubt that anybody could come in and take that over. They have to be able to do this. And it's a difficult task. And we can only have faith in the Boeing company's ability to actually handle the systems integration. I don't know if that didn't really directly apply to your question, but it really matters. It really matters. There's some things that a third party just can't do.
Now, I'm not afraid that we're giving people an education, a drink of water with a fire hose. We are. There's a lot of stuff here. And then, the usual member of the public who follows along with the trials and tribulations of Boeing doesn't really get exposed to what we're talking about in the major media and not even in the aviation media often. So, if I were to have a second or last word, it's like it would be on the order of this is a very complex process that takes many, many people who are dedicated to what they're doing. But there are ways that you can put things together or change how the system works, that could put that system back in a direction that people will have more faith in. And I just hope that what you're saying and what you've been saying here, what you said in your op-ed, will have an effect at some level of decision-making, either in Washington, D.C., or in wherever the headquarters of Boeing is right now.
I just think it's nice to have somebody throwing some potential solutions in the ring here. We're not hearing a lot of that, honestly. No, you know, really, you know, we bemoan it, but I don't hear, I hear a lot of talk from Boeing, which doesn't amount to anything. I don't, I the FAA doesn't seem to be, they seem to be quiet, probably afraid to step in at this point. So hearing you, you know, at least offer some ideas is great. So thank you, Mike.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Thank you very much. You know, I couldn't have said better, any better what you gentlemen have talked about. I think, you know, the FAA is in a sense, they are frozen because moving the Boeing company goes back to the notion of actually turning the battleship. You know, the FAA only has the ODA. The only action they can take with any certificate holder is against that particular certificate, and they cannot shut the company down. They're doing what they can. They're limiting production rates and so on. But this goes again back to this the Supreme Court decision from 1984. The FAA doesn't have the accountability. Boeing has the accountability. They're the ones who have to go to the FAA and say, here's what we're going to do. Here's our plan. Let's write something up, sign a contract, watch. Here's what we're going to do. They're not doing it. So I'm not concerned about the FAA. It's up to the Boeing company.
Too big to fail, right?
Yep, exactly. I hate that phrase, but it's absolutely correct. Yeah. You know, Boeing has tendrils all over the place. Right now, they have a tendril going up, you know, a few thousand miles and above the ground. You know, there's something else I want to tell you about. I know we're getting ready to close, but there's a thing called CDPO, Certificated Design and Production Organization. Craig Beard, who was the chief of aircraft certification, retired around 96, 95. He was hired by the Boeing company as a contractor to write up the next generation of delegation. And he wrote a white paper. I got to work with him. They put these two FAA people together when I was there, and I was able to work with them writing a white paper. And I don't necessarily say work with him because I was really sitting at his feet. He was a marvelous, wonderful guy. And he wrote this white paper. The Boeing company then got the FAA to put together an ARC, an Aviation Rulemaking Committee, that was headed up by Craig Beard's successor. That was Tom McSweeney. Tom McSweeney headed this thing up. They actually put together a potential documentation that would explain what this CDPO is all about. And really, it's the CDPO for the type certification portion was anybody who has this certificate is able to just first go to the FAA, say, we're doing this project, and then go to the FAA when they're done and say, it's done now. Here's the certificate. You're out of it. The FAA totally, totally out of it. With, you know, some requirements. It became law. It went to Congress. It became law in 2012. You can find it. I actually have a track record with, you know, footnotes and links and so on and so forth. So it was made law in 2012. Then in 2020, it was repealed. So I call this Boeing giveth, Boeing taketh away. Boeing put this thing in place. They had a wonderful strategy. The concept, by the way, is perfect. It's a great, marvelous concept, but it depends upon the integrity of the certificate holder. We started our conversation with this. And so Boeing put this in place. They had the strategy. They actually worked the process, got it made law. And then because of their behavior, it came to an end for the entire industry. And that is a sad, sad story to tell. I can share it with you later. I can give you the details, but it's a true story. I have all the information. I have everything you might need to write a book about this. And I guess that's it. I'm done with that part anyway.
We might have you back and talk about that on a future podcast.
I think there's another episode to do here. You just set it up, didn't you? Fabulous.
Just
really, really, really interesting. So good to hear your thoughts.
Thank you, gentlemen. You know, in closing, I just want to say that I really don't care if someone takes this up or not. I really believe, honestly, that it could work. I believe there's a way. I think there are benefits for all parties across the board. But what I really want to see is some discussion. You know, Miles, you mentioned you haven't heard anybody do anything like this. And that's sort of what got me going, got me thinking about this. What you really need is a robust conversation in the open about what might actually work. I'm convinced a monitor will not do the job.
I think we can all agree on that. They're going to handpick somebody. That's not going to do it. We know that. I think we all know that.
It's too binary. You've got to find a way to move forward with this whole thing and make it last.
And for our very last word, back to you, John.
All right. So this time I'm not going to close with my normal last word. I'm going to close with, we took a different tact on this podcast, and we've stepped into the arena with possible solutions for all the problems that we hear being lamented about across the board. And we're just throwing this out to, as Mike said, to raise the bar in the discussions. And so it's a little different tack for us. And I'm anxious to see what our audience thinks about this and thinks about the discussion and the challenge to get them thinking. I know it's too deep for the average person, the average flying person, right? But some people will listen to it and some people will understand it. So we're not going to stop. We're about safety. All of us on this podcast today are all about safety. All of us fly a lot, and we're concerned about all the others that fly as well. So we're going to continue to push the envelope wherever we can to try to make knowledgeable people think about what they're doing and what they can do better.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.